Drugs was presented by Nancy Scott on May 18, 2004 at McKinsey Study Center's Tuesday night class. This is the eighth talk in part three of a series entitled Doing Christianity. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Well, series this spring is Doing Christianity, Living the Christian Life, and my topic tonight is on drugs. When I thought about doing this topic, I thought about a couple of different directions I could go with it, and in the end I decided I would combine them in a way and just kind of have a couple of different arms to the talk, and certainly I will want to leave some time at the end for discussion and questions and interaction, because I like learning that way and working that way better than me just talking. But I do have a few things to share. It's kind of an odd thing to just start talking about is drugs, but I started thinking about what's our first kind of hit at doing, at thinking about drug use or kind of the idea of what drives us in that direction in the scriptures. And I thought about the Garden of Eden and how from the very beginning, from the fall, we are people who hide, and we hide from reality and we avoid reality. And that's a picture of that experience in the garden when Adam and Eve were guilty, and the first thing they did was cover their bodies in order to hide from God in some way. And I think that we hide from reality in a number of different ways, and it's something that we talk a lot about around here, I think. This talk, centering on drug use and drug taking, I'm going to divide in kind of three different parts, roughly. First, I'll talk a little bit about recreational drug taking, and then I'll say a few words about prescription drugs and the kind of state of our culture and our ideas about the role of prescription drugs. And then last, I'll talk about how we're to think about that from a Christian perspective, both of those things, as well as the ways that we can turn pretty much anything into a drug. It doesn't have to be a chemical substance. But I am actually going to focus mostly on chemicals for tonight. There are certainly early references in scriptures to drinking, to wine and alcohol consumption. It's typically in the Bible, I think, there's two sides to the Bible's history or, you know, discussion of drinking wine, drinking alcoholic beverages. One is that it's actually a very celebratory and commemorative thing to do, is to enjoy wine as a gift from God. Certainly the people of Israel instructed to participate in Passover and celebrate these different feast days. They were not non-alcoholic events. There's also a reference in the Psalms about the psalmist saying that he's thankful to God for wine which makes man's heart glad. And I think that there's really a sense of a gift that God has given us in wine as a, you know, example of an alcoholic beverage. However, there's also this other side to it, and that is that it's very easily abused and very easily misused. And so we have, as early as Noah, someone who drinks way too much and then does some unspeakable things that he ends up having very serious repercussions from, the destructive moral choices that came out of his drunkenness. So there's both of these things. There's this celebratory part to alcohol, and then there's also this very easily abused part. And I think that that's a really important distinction that we need to make. Paul also talks in Ephesians about not being drunk, because it's dissipation. It's a kind of a way of being asleep, I think, is what he's saying. It's like We're not, we're just kind of frittering away our lives and not awake for them. And that, and he talks about that. Okay. So those are kind of early references. So drugs have really been around as long as people have been around. I think there's been ways to find substances that alter our consciousness. And certainly there's lots of natural substances that have been discovered for various uses, both medicinally and recreationally, for as long as humans have been around. I think we kind of have a different history today in our culture. Schaefer actually talks about in How Should We Then Live about the genesis of the drug culture, and he does a really good job, I think, of talking about the worldview that has promoted a more acceptable drug culture that we now kind of live with. He talks about how drugs have been around forever, but it wasn't really until the 60s that drug taking became an ideology that was rooted in this idea that we were pessimistic about whether or not reason had any answers, whether the Christian worldview of the culture had any validity, and so reality became something that was just inside of our own heads, and we could define it, create it, augment it, and use chemicals to do that. And in fact, it became a real ideology. Now, he says that that didn't last very long. I think that that's true on a historical level. He talks about how by the time people like Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin overdosed in like 1970, that the ideology was kind of blown out at that point because it failed as an answer. And I think that that's true culturally speaking, but I think that subculturally speaking, that's not entirely true. And I think we can find a lot of different subcultures these days where there is still a real ideology that drug taking is a way to experience life and a way to embrace life that is a really important passage. So I think that there's a lot of stuff that goes on, and I certainly am not that in touch with the drug culture of today. I was more in touch with it. My drug experiences and interaction with that culture are fairly outdated now, but I think that there are some real common features, if we will, even though the chemicals may have changed slightly. There's certainly a sense of nihilism that I think is often implicit in drug taking and embracing drug taking. Even marijuana use. I think we can look at marijuana as a substance that is kind of benign in some way. But the fact is that there really is a difference between something like wine and something like marijuana, where for wine actually can be a beverage as opposed to strictly being abused, kind of as I was saying in the scriptures, where there's this celebratory role that wine plays, even though, and I think there's something about it making us glad that's in that psalmist perspective. It's not that there's no effect of it, but it's not, it's certainly more related to the amount that's ingested and how affected you are by it, where more and more, especially these days with the various kinds of marijuana that's grown, there's really no middle ground. It's kind of all or nothing. And it's the purpose of smoking grass is to get stoned. And so there's kind of a distinction there, I think, that we can make where most of the drugs that people do recreationally these days are very much about finding an altered state of consciousness, being stoned, checking out, just being gone or having some experience. So harder drugs, hallucinogens, opiates, they're often rooted in this nihilistic view that it really doesn't matter and that really we're this ball of chemicals anyway, and there's no sense in not stimulating the chemicals in our brain in such a way that's recreational. There's really no reason not to, because truth is inside of our own heads, experience is everything. Why not embellish that and augment that through drug taking? So it's kind of rooted in this view of life that we're nothing but chemical receptors that may as well be used for entertainment. So, and yet, honestly, I think that this is a very sad state of affairs. And I think that beginning with whatever cultural forces have brought us to this point, it's a very sad and empty place that our culture has left us with nothing more than that kind of an experience with which to feel alive. And I think of it that way. I know that that was a lot of it for me when I was experimenting with various substances, that it had to do with broadening experience or finding such bankruptcy in what was around me that there wasn't any point not to. It was just something else to do that made sense out of the craziness, and that there was this sort of sense that nothing made sense anyway. Why not just feel good? Why not just expand your mind? So the sad thing is, another sad piece of this is that I think these days, perhaps I think in 20 years ago as well, in my experience, but even more so these days, there is absolutely no control on manufacturing of these substances, and therefore it's a really dangerous thing to fool around with. And I think that we just live in a really dangerous society where drugs are so widely available and very poorly regulated, and there's no accountability for manufacturers or sellers. And the situation across the street here of binge drinking and date rape drugs, things that are slipped into people's drinks, it's just not a safe place anymore. And I know I had a young friend a while back after I had become a Christian again who I met and who was experimenting with LSD at the time, and he was kind of, I think, afraid I was going to tell his parents that he was doing that because I was friends with his parents. But I remember talking to him about it and saying that, you know, I wasn't going to tell his parents, but unless I felt like he was going to be in danger at some point. But I just remember thinking to him and saying to him, just live through it. Whatever it is you're working through, just figure out a way to live through it, because a lot of people don't. And I think that was one of the really rude awakenings for me, was recognizing that people die for the cause of figuring this stuff out. And it's really not a safe thing to experiment with. And I think even short of people dying, there's a lot of alteration that happens in our minds that can end up being quite long lasting. And it's very sad. So I think that the moral issue of drug taking rests in the way that it's a way of hiding from reality, more so than it's automatically wrong to do something like this. It's that it's hiding from reality, and I think you could expand even Paul's admonition about the wastefulness of it when it comes to questions of the safety and security of youth, which feels invincible and feels like there's nothing that could ever hurt us, and yet finds out that people die. And I mean, that's the ultimate dissipation, if you will, is to waste a life in that way. So that's my little sermon. I think it's really sad that we live in a culture where nihilism is praised and even death itself is seen as kind of welcomed as some kind of final experience. Okay, so what do we actually believe if we're Christians? What do we believe about this? If we embrace the view of life found in the Bible, then we really have to come up against this idea that there's really nothing meaningful about life, and that we may as well eat, drink, be merry, for tomorrow we die. So ultimately, the assumptions that worldview is grounded in are not true, Because some of the assumptions that are behind that is that life is meaningless, that life is random. And if we believe what the Bible is saying, this life is actually full of purpose and meaning and is actually scripted by a wise and loving God who is very involved in the details of our lives and who is really there and who is actually taking history in a particular direction and is actually taking my life and my experience in a particular direction. I think that what we also believe if we take the Bible seriously is that being awake is valuable. That as hard as reality is at times, the reality that God has designed for us is that it is the classroom in which we grow into maturity and into understanding our faith and understanding what's important from God's vantage point. And if we believe what the Bible says and embrace what the Bible says, then it will be important to us to value what God values and to work at understanding life from his vantage point. As difficult as this life is, and as attractive as drug use can be, those are the things that we're saying we're committed to if we're committed to the Bible, to the view of life found in the Bible. So I think that we're called to be awake in this way. Okay, so I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about that was sort of the recreational drug topic and perhaps illegal drug use. I want to talk a little bit about legal drug use, prescription drugs, and kind of how we look at those things as well. In my counseling practice, I've had the opportunity to do a bit of reading on the development and use of antidepressants and various other psychoactive drugs, and I think that I just wondered about whether or not to talk about this subject because it's something that I can get kind of fired up about. But I think it's really important that we evaluate the culture that we live in terms of legal drugs as well and in terms of prescription drugs. I think it's important that we know there's a worldview behind our culture's use of those and perhaps its overuse of those. For one thing, the pharmaceutical companies that are behind much of the drug marketing to physicians traditionally and now to directly to patients through their ad campaigns have a very primary goal. And their primary goal is to protect the investment of their stockholders. That means that their primary goal is to make money. And so they are looking for markets. They are looking for ways to increase their market share. Does everybody that works for a pharmaceutical company want nothing but money? No. There's some nobility in trying to alleviate human suffering as well. But I think that we need to know that in terms of the force behind it, this money-making force drives the advertising campaigns. It drives the ideas that we get filtered through us that say the purple pill is what will make life a bed of clover. And we see this stuff on TV all the time. Or the bouncy pill will make you happy in crowds and, you know, will take away your social anxiety. I think that's the one. Is that the bouncy pill that does that? I don't know. Anyway, I read recently in a Time magazine article on Prozac Nation and kind of the use of Prozac since its introduction in the late 1980s. And basically they were talking about the tendency now toward seeing Prozac as something that can be used much more broadly than just for depression, that Prozac can actually help us feel better than well. We can be well, but why not feel better than well? And this is Prozac's new role. And so, and I've heard story after story of people who have gone to the doctor and said they haven't been sleeping well or, you know, something's going on, and the doctor immediately says, you're depressed. Let's try Prozac. And I just think it's unconscionable, frankly. I read a story just today about a guy who went to his doctor for various symptoms. They prescribed Prozac. He said he felt so much worse that he stopped it almost immediately. and then went back to the doctor who said, well, it's because of your underlying depression that you're resistant to this drug and to taking the drug. And so if you would just take it and get used to it, it could really help you. And so he took it again. He tried it again, and he stayed on it a little longer that time, but he still went off of it fairly quickly because he just felt horrible. And he knew that it was related to the Prozac, and he began to have all kinds of symptoms that actually persisted after he went off of the drug and continues to struggle to this day. There are some really scary stories out there about Prozac use, and it is a drug that is handed out like candy these days. So I guess I just say that because I don't think we hear about the downside of drugs like Prozac enough. When they're absolutely needed, they're a really good thing. I think that the trouble is that they're so broadly prescribed these days by doctors who are not necessarily specializing in psychiatric illness and are just seen as something that you can try to see if it helps you feel better, rather than diagnosing major clinical depression and deciding that this is the drug of choice for this illness, for this person. Does that make sense? There's a really big difference there. Okay. So there's another assumption that this whole practice is rooted in that I think it's important that we're aware of, and that's kind of, it's this reductionistic notion that we're really just a ball of chemicals, and anything that happens to us can be alleviated by intervening on a chemical level. And I think that's another assumption that we really need to take issue with. That any cure is going to be effected by a change in the chemical mix. I wanted to read a section. This is in this same report that I was talking about, the guy who was given the Prozac and then had a lot of trouble with it. This is a Belgian doctor who was interviewed for this report. So this is European information more than American, but he says that doctors should know more about the drugs that they prescribe, adding that Belgian doctors prescribe twice the amount of psychiatric drugs per person as their Dutch counterparts. Most psychiatrists know little apart from the promotional material that the drug companies send them. Years later, they make their own observations about a drug's efficacy. Meanwhile, the patients suffer. For Van Meerdemock, who's this Dutch physician, this is a reductionist view. It's naive to say that a malfunction in the neurotransmitter system is the main cause of depression and that the illness can be treated by drugs. It's also convenient for employers, families, and society to blame individual failings on biochemistry rather than confront social problems like unemployment. Now, I would go on to say that I think even more importantly, what we don't confront when we see kind of this reductionistic view that it's all chemistry, brain chemistry, is that we have a lot of, there are experiences that happen in our lives that we react to with emotions and with the brain chemistry that God has given us. And I often see people in my office who I think that we can get very confused about the difference between grief and depression, for example. Because, say, someone has lost a family member. Well, and now actually they're prescribing a lot of Prozac in that kind of situation as well, because grief might be uncomfortable for people. And I just think that it's really important to know that grief, for example, is a God-given response to a real loss. And so often, I think depression is a response to loss that, in a way, goes underground because it hasn't been able to be expressed. And so when antidepressants are called for, they're a great thing to help people who have gotten to a point that they need a medical intervention. But I think, in general, we need to broaden our view of what depression is and what struggle is and what its role is in our lives, and that taking a drug that changes our perceptions and our experiences is really a big deal. And taking a medication that affects brain chemistry is a really big deal. So what's really true about this then? Certainly brain chemistry is a reality, but I think that it needs to be broadened to know that there's also a lot of feedback mechanisms going on. So brain chemistry isn't acting in a vacuum. It's acting in response to the bigger picture and the more complex picture of who we are as human beings. And we aren't just our brain chemistry. And certainly that kind of feedback mechanism is not, it's not even being studied in terms of what role, you know, which comes first, the depression or the brain chemistry changes. It's not studied because, frankly, the pharmaceutical companies aren't interested in studying that. So, and much of the research is funded by the pharmaceutical companies. That's part of the problem. So the risk of accepting our culture's view without a critique of it, and this would go, I think, for recreational drugs as well as pharmaceutical drugs, is that we're talking about very powerful drugs, and anything that alters our brain chemistry and our perceptions is a really big deal to your body. And I think that that's an important thing to keep in mind. The downsides of these drugs are rarely publicized. So, in terms of prescription pharmaceuticals, in the best case, I think the specialty nature of these drugs is being lost, and too many doctors are prescribing these drugs without enough oversight, and it results in very difficult outcomes for a lot of people. A third risk, I think, is that we can be, I think, a little too trusting at times of the various checks and balances that we have in our system. And this comes into play in terms of children and antidepressants. There's been a lot of news lately about the FDA approving Prozac use for children under 14 now, under 18. It went under 18 a year or so ago, and I think it's now under 14. The research on the developing brain and the effect of these chemicals on the developing brain is very sparse, and the FDA has not approved many of these drugs at all for use in children, and yet they're used often. And doctors basically, I mean, this is true with any medication really. If someone takes a drug for treating one thing and it turns out that it also helps with this other thing, well, this other patient that's going to come in with this other thing, even though the FDA doesn't say that it's okay to prescribe this drug for this other thing, the doctor's very likely to prescribe it anyway because it's helpful for that other thing. And in general, that's a standard practice, and that's okay. I mean, I think that's an okay thing. But when it comes to prescribing these drugs to children, I think it communicates something really... I think we need to be careful about what that communicates to our children, for one thing. One is that... because obviously it's often very well-intentioned and very much our children are struggling, we want to help them. And we go to the doctor and the doctor says this is how we can help them. That's what we want to do. And yet I think too often it communicates to the child that their brain chemistry is the problem rather than what is life like and how do we deal with life. I hesitated to talk about this because I just think it's a very complex issue, and I by no means mean to be saying that these drugs can sometimes be helpful, but I think that they are not as often helpful as we've been led to believe, and that we need to question that. So again, what do we believe? And if we love God and believe what the Bible says about life, then I think we believe that humans are much more complex than our brain chemistry, and that this life is full of purpose and meaning, because God is really there and taking history in a particular direction and taking my life in a particular direction. That means that that whatever struggles come to us are designed by God to take us in a particular direction. And so even the choice of trying a medication, stopping a medication, trying a different one, even that process, I think, is orchestrated ultimately by God for us to be struggling with what's true and what's valuable. And I think we just need to be asking the question, is this the best thing? Is this the best way to go about this? I think that, and this takes me to my last section, which is about how we can turn anything into a drug. We're very creative about how we hide from things, how we hide from life, and how we hide from difficulty in particular. We can use our careers, our activities, our hobbies, our relationships. We can use just about anything as a drug. And I think that that's another thing that we really, as people who are trying to trust God and understand who God is, we need to be awake to the ways that we leave reality, to the ways that we don't want to be here, because they are significant, and it's very difficult to be here very often. And yet God is in the midst of this, teaching us and caring about us and working to build our faith in the midst. We have been told over and over by our culture that we don't need to suffer. And I think this is the primary assumption that we need to question. I'm not into promoting suffering or suffering for suffering's sake. If there is legitimate help for suffering, I think it's really okay to take it. But I think that we go too quickly to thinking that suffering is abnormal, rather than that it's part of this life, that we have difficulty and that we have loss and that we have pain. And I wanted to say a couple of other things about addiction and the ways that we can be drawn toward a particular activity or a particular substance or whatever. I think that part of being awake is going to include knowing what my body is telling me. And this is part of being awake that I think we don't pay enough attention to sometimes. That if I notice that I can't sit still and I want to always keep going and going and going, and or if I sit down and I'm just beat and I think, I need a beer or I need a strong drink or something to relax me, or any kind of, I mean, I think maybe you guys probably all have had the experience of being driven in a way that that I need something to fix this thing that's going on inside of me and I don't want to sit still with it. I think that's the very thing that it would be really good to sit still with. And I know that in my own experience it has been very important that I have learned to sit still with a lot of stuff. I referenced earlier my own experience of the drug culture, and in particular for me, I wanted to share part of that experience that there was a time when I went through a very traumatic loss of a friend. I've mentioned this, probably some of you guys have heard me tell the story about a close friend of mine in my 20s who was murdered. And when that experience happened, this kind of ties this together, because when that experience happened for me, that was an experience that totally pulled the rug out from under me in terms of what I thought life was going to be like, what I thought I could expect, what I thought was okay. And I was not a Christian at the time. I did not value what the Bible had to say about things. Just in terms of regular out there life, it raised this huge question for me and told me that life must be meaningless. If this kind of thing can happen, there must be no reasonable hope for finding meaning here. And it really unraveled me in a lot of ways. In response to that experience, I basically climbed into a bottle and stayed there for about a year. And I drank really heavily, and I continued to work. I was pretty good at getting to work in spite of how I felt, but I was not okay. And there were times when I thought I was gonna maybe not make it to work and maybe not work very well because I was starting to drink more and more. As I came out of that experience and had to work with the idea of what I was doing there, kind of there was so much of it was involved with refusing, in a way, refusing the grief of this terrible loss and just refusing to know how painful that was for me. It was so painful that I just had to leave. And that was how I chose to leave. In the intervening years, after I managed to stop drinking, actually stopped drinking heavily, before, it was probably a year or so before I became a Christian again that this happened. And by the time I became a Christian again, I really wasn't drinking that heavily at that point. But it took me a long time to put together kind of what was going on for me in that whole period. And not only that, but it really opened up to me a recognition of the role of alcohol in my own life even before that, when I wasn't necessarily that heavy of a drinker, but very much understood drinking as something that was a tension reliever and, you know, really something that was okay. And I had this drive. And so I guess what I'm trying to get at this kind of idea, this drive. I actually still at this point in my life, as most of you know, enjoy a good beer. I enjoy a good glass of wine. There's a real difference that I feel inside of myself when I'm hiding, when I'm wanting to go there out of this drive, that I'm not okay with what life is handing me, or I'm losing ground, or I'm kind of ruffled by whatever it is that's going on. And because I've begun to understand what that feels like, I can differentiate when that's there and when it's not. And it hasn't been there with drinking for quite a while now, but it's something that I had to go through a long process to really even uncover that. And I'm not sure how I could describe that entirely. But so I don't know if I'm making any sense at all. But just that I think that we each know on the inside of us what our motivations are, even when they're not particularly clear. So even if I don't know why I'm drawn to something, I know that I am drawn to it. And I know that there's something pushing me toward this other way out, this other thing. And that's the thing that I think we can really benefit from listening to, that drive and that push. And the way that we benefit from listening to that is by recognizing what about that is our very basic refusal of reality, and what about that is the very thing that God wants to confront us with and teach us how to trust Him with. That's the rub where I think addiction and drug use and substances can really be subtle in the ways that they can keep us from knowing those things. Just like any way that we hide can do that, whether it's working all the time or playing all the time or whatever we find to be addictive with. So that's that part. So in closing, I just want to kind of sum up and say that the thing that I think we need to really keep in mind is that the nihilism that drives drug use so much in our culture is basically a lie, and that life is not random. It looks like life is random, but life is not random. If we believe what the Bible has to say, we believe that life is not random, and that rather it is full of purpose and meaning, and that God really is there, and He really is taking history in a particular direction, and He's really taking me and my life in a particular direction. And there's not really accidents that happen along that way. And that even includes an experience like mine going through the murder of my friend, or even my friend's life, whose life was actually in God's hands all the while. It becomes an opportunity for us to understand reality from God's perspective, and also to trust, knowing that we're creatures and that He's the Creator and we're not. And so we don't really have jurisdiction over those things, and that puts us in a very vulnerable place. So I just encourage us to evaluate the principles and presuppositions that surround our perceptions about drugs, whether they be illegal drugs or legal drugs, and that we evaluate and stay awake inside of our lives and be aware of what things drive us toward hiding in a lot of different ways. So, okay. I hope I've left a little bit of time for discussion, questions, ideas. Anyone?
Have you put any thought into what drives them? What's going on there?
Well, I don't know that even the most sophisticated drug users are necessarily sophisticated philosophers about why they're taking drugs. But I do think that there's this, I think that we breathe in the nihilism in our culture in a really subtle way. And so in some ways, I think the 13-year-olds are nihilists. But I think there's also all kinds of other factors. Peer pressure, of course, being a big one. And but yeah, actually, I think we're breeding pretty young nihilists these days. Breeding, cultivating, whatever, you know what I mean?
I think it's actually surprising how young the effect of the darkness of our culture is seeping down such that it's even promoted as being hip. I'll be talking about that a little bit next week with movies and films and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. I've been in environments where it was so not okay to use Prozac or drugs for depression and things like that, that they would consider them like unholy and like evil because they wouldn't rely on God. They would use this pill instead.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell what it looks like to like have it be legitimate?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I by no means mean to communicate that anyone who takes a medication is rebelling against God. I don't know if I could describe exactly what that might look like, other than to say that we, in being awake, we evaluate the treatment options in a way that takes into account what the options are, what different people's experiences are, and what is going on in that particular circumstance. It could be that it's a very appropriate choice, and certainly at the point where I think that there's often cases where, particularly in the event of psychosis, where drugs are very necessary. And I also think that there can be, let me think about this. And in those situations, I think it's an incredible gift that we live in a time when the technology is there to bring someone back from psychosis, because psychosis is a really devastating thing. And it has not been that long that's been available. So I think that's a really valuable thing.
Could you define psychosis, what you mean by psychosis as compared to other kinds of mental emotional issues?
Psychosis is kind of a break with reality. It happens when, in an illness like schizophrenia, where there might be auditory hallucinations, people hearing somebody talking to them, or someone thinking that there's people in the room that aren't there, paranoia can be a symptom of kind of an impending psychosis or that kind of thing. So it's a real break from reality where and it can be a very long road back for people. And I don't think that it's I think that, and there's some medications that are really helpful at calming down what's going on in the brain when that happens, so that the person can come back into themselves. And I think in those kind of situations, there's also cases where, I want to make a distinction here. Maybe this will help. We have this idea in our culture that everything is curable with a drug. That's what I want to challenge. What needs a drug ought to have a drug, maybe is a way that I could say it. But I think that in terms of, we've blurred the lines so much by making definitions like calling alcoholism a disease, for example, where it's really, there's some evidence that there really is a physical component to alcoholism, that some people's livers metabolize alcohol in a really different way that make them instantly drunk and instantly addicted. And now that's a medical issue. That is a very rare thing compared to the number of alcoholics who you might find at any typical AA meeting. So we've really blurred the lines about what a real illness is, I think. And I think that's an important distinction. So that there really are people who have illnesses that need medication. There can be, there really is a bipolar disorder that happens that's an organic problem that is not based on behavioral choices and cannot necessarily be controlled by behavioral choices. I'm struggling for the words, but there's true illnesses, there's true mental illnesses that that where a chemical imbalance is really something going on, whether from an injury or any kind of condition that can happen. I think that those are the problem is that we're not making distinctions there either, and anybody who goes to a doctor's office could be told that they are bipolar when they don't really have the experience or the expertise to be saying that. Rather, they should be referring that person to a psychiatrist for an evaluation, someone who's seen true bipolar disorder and understands it and can recognize it. Is that helpful?
Yes.
What else are you going to add?
Also with depression, though, because that's more of a questionable something. Like, I've had friends with depression that I'm like, you just have problem getting over things, and like mm-hmm. you're just not at the mature enough level where you can deal with your own existence and where you're at this moment. And there are other people that I've seen with depression that I'm like, you know, like, you need to see someone. Like, there's something going on where you do have a break from reality. And what do you say to people who are depressed when it comes to taking pills and whatnot? Like, mm-hmm. I know it's a fine line. It would be hard to describe all the little
right, and it is.
Them. And if that's
it's,
yeah.
I think it's very difficult to make generalizations. But I do think, again, that what you're onto is that there's a difference between the two. And in that case, I mean, I think that's a good example where you know the difference when you see it. It's kind of not that I'm saying that we're all diagnosticians. I don't think we are. But there are people who can be diagnosed and who need to meet certain criteria in order to be diagnosed. And I don't think that happens that often. It's more if you feel blue or if you... I don't know how many people have told me about going to the doctor's office and being in a bad mood for a week or two, and the doctor says, well, maybe you're depressed, just try this. And it's just astounding to me. When actual clinical depression, major depressive episode in the DSM-IV, requires things like 6 months of chronic depressive ideation and... there's several other criteria that I don't remember right now, but there's also a time frame with it. It has to have gone on for a certain period of time, and they don't even pay attention to that, hardly at all. So, Is that helpful?
Yeah.
I was just thinking about, I don't know if this is helpful with the distinction, but maybe the difference between someone needing medication for depression or whatever and not needing it is someone needing medication when the depression is what's, they're kind of, what you're calling, you know, a break from reality, a kind of, is something, is them not facing reality through being depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And not being able to get out of that, whereas the misusing the drugs is to treat people who aren't, don't necessarily have real clinical depression or whatever, is more of using the drugs is the way to get away from reality. So it's like, I'm just wondering if maybe that's more of the difference between the two.
Okay, say it once more. How would you define the two?
Just that... using the drugs to treat a disease that, I mean, because I know when people get into depression, the idea is to get them out of that so they can get back to reality, so they're not,
mm-hmm.
you know, ignore, so they're not separated from reality or in depression or psychosis or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But then using the drugs to treat depression that doesn't really need them to treat it, that's kind of an escape from reality. It's an escape from whatever pain that the person is going through. Does that make sense?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think that's part of what I'm getting at, is that there really are medical conditions for which drugs are very helpful. When we start to use a drug like Prozac in order to feel better than well, there's a problem. So, yeah. And I think depression is a very real thing, and I don't want to discount that. It's a very deep struggle for a lot of people, and yet it's more complicated than the brain chemistry. And what I often, the way I often think about it is that it could be that it's a biochemical thing going on, but it could be that the way I've responded to what's happened in my life over time is what's prompted that chemical imbalance. I can take the drug to fix the imbalance, but I haven't really addressed what got me there to begin with. And I think that's an important piece. So another admonition I would make, or a recommendation I would make, is that people not take antidepressant medication apart from doing other things in order to kind of address the depression on a more holistic level. And I think that happens way too often, too, is that people are prescribed a medication and just said, you know, that'll do it. And I don't think it will. I think it needs to be a more complex treatment that certainly the drug can be a part of, and a very helpful part of at times, but it's bigger than that. It's more than that, and it needs to be more than that.
I have a friend who has depression, and I've talked to them before, and they told me that depression is not feeling sad. Depression is like being unmotivated to do things.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, I mean, is that a good understanding of what depression is?
Yeah.
Or what true depression is, or something like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that often I talk about it often in the context of depression and anxiety being two sides of the same coin, and that some of us respond to fear by becoming anxious, some of us respond to sadness by becoming depressed. Both are ways to not feel the real feeling, which is sadness or fear. And I think that that's a helpful way to look at it. It's not across the board, it's not 100%, but I think it's often the case that, and people who struggle with depression will often say things like, it is more of an unmotivatedness. It's kind of a numbness, almost. It's a numbing out that happens. It's not really, I mean, it feels horrible, but it's also, it feels numb. And that's part of the problem. So, yeah, I think that's probably a real accurate description. Does that make sense with kind of, I think we go different places with fear and sadness, and anxiety can be similar a way that we're not feeling what we're afraid of, but rather spinning out into a state of being anxious, because that's a distraction. It can be a real distraction. I can worry about whether I left the oven on, because I don't want to feel how afraid I am that my house could burn down, or that my life is out of my control, and on a bigger level. I mean, I really think that we should be afraid in this life. Fear is a legitimate feeling that reflects true reality, and there's a lot to be afraid of. Now, we need to work with that fear and end up trusting God with it, but it's real. Fear is very real, and I think sadness is very real and very appropriate to be sad in the face of loss, to be sad in the face of the difficulties of this life is really appropriate. And that's another place where we don't go there. And I think that's where we need to go, rather than to feeling better quickly. Because we could still miss. Does that make sense? Because if we feel better quickly, it's great to feel better, but we could really miss something true. And I think God wants us to know what's really true.
I have a few questions. First one is, to you, what's the difference between morphine and heroin?
The difference between morphine and heroin? Gee, my biochemistry is a little rusty. I think it depends on, isn't it a synthetic difference? I mean, morphine is the pure form and heroin is more refined.
What's like the usage?
Oh, the difference in usage?
Like, are you uncomfortable with the idea of replacing like morphine with heroin? Because they kind of have the same effect, but not because of pain and whatnot.
Is that what you're asking? Like the difference between using morphine versus in a medical context versus using heroin in a street context? Okay. Well, morphine is actually fairly widely used, of course, at the end of life to dull intractable pain, because it's very painful. Cancer pain, for example, it's very effective against very deep pain, deep tissue pain, physically. I would say that in a medical context, that might be an appropriate use, where in a social context, heroin use is not really aimed at numbing a deep physical pain like that, so much as perhaps a deep emotional pain. And again, I think even medically, we need to be looking at what's the treatment that's going on here. Is there some way to address what's happening that's causing the pain? Is there a cancer that can be removed, for example? Or is it merely making the end of life more comfortable for someone? Versus the emotional pain, again, I would say we need to look at the emotional pain and what can we do to address that level, rather than working on the symptom level, maybe. Is that?
And the other one is, you talked about hiding from your emotions in everyday life. Mm-hmm. So if we aren't hiding from something while using our drug, would it be fine to use it?
I don't know that that's possible.
Like, as in drinking alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
You're not hiding from your, hiding from some sort of real life fact.
Right, right. Well, that's in an appropriate use of alcohol. I would say that's true. But most other drugs, there's not really the distinction. Does that make sense? It's like alcohol is a beverage as well as a drug. So it can be used as a beverage and not necessarily as a drug. Most of the other drugs out there really don't have a beverage function, if you will. Does that make sense?
Yes.
What about entertainment purposes?
I don't think that's an appropriate use for alcohol either. I mean, because it is hiding.
Is Wait, not all entertainment is hiding, I would say. Would you disagree with that? Like, there's...
No, yeah, no.
Okay,
right.
So then could not, marijuana be used for an entertainment sake? I'm bored, why not smoke weed? I know plenty of people who this is... sometimes I would also believe that sometimes their motivation is they're just bored. Is that... Mm-hmm. Would you say that that was... I mean, not to condone that it's okay, certainly, but I mean, like, is that less of a problem?
Well, I think it comes back to this idea of whether or not we're awake. And I think that there's a lot of entertainment. I mean, this is what Wes is going to talk about next week, right? Some of it. I think there actually is a lot of entertainment that is hiding these days. And there's a really, I think that's a very important distinction to make, is at what point is our entertainment hiding? Jack, Wes, they're both wanting to say something.
I was just going to say that a lot of boredom today is, I think, symptomatic of meaninglessness. You know, we live in a culture that's breeding and fostering literal meaninglessness. And so people have... That just leads to, nothing means anything to me. I try this, it doesn't mean anything. I try this, it doesn't mean anything. My life doesn't mean anything. So they're bored. So boredom is a symptom of that. And so that's why so many people use anything and everything as a drug to entertain themselves or hide. You know, hiding is maybe a little bit more... sort of hardcore denial of reality, whereas entertainment is a milder form of denying reality. Trying to entertain myself to death, you know.
Okay, that makes me curious. So for either of you or anybody else, if I'm not that I do schoolwork very much, but if I were like doing a paper, like maybe back in the day when I used to do a paper, or something, like, I'd be like, okay, man, that's a lot of work. I think I'll go watch a movie now. Or, like, man, I'm bored out of my mind. Why don't I go watch a movie? That's not a bad idea. I've been kind of wanting to see Big Fish. Do you think either of those is crossing a line that I shouldn't be?
I think, again, it's a little too reductionistic where there's going to be, like, this definite line. I think that it's not so much that we're trying to figure out how to get it right, as we are to work with what happens when we get it wrong.
So then am I correct in saying you wouldn't say that taking a break from reality is a problem, it's the avoidance of reality that's a problem?
Well, I don't know about I don't think relaxing is taking a break from reality.
Okay.
I think relaxing is a legitimate thing to do. We sleep for... I could go on about sleep and how we don't get enough of it in this culture. Sleep is a very good thing. And power naps are a very good thing. They help you relax and sleep better at night. Did you know that? 20-minute power nap and you'll sleep better at night. Doctor's orders. So relaxing is not the problem. The avoiding reality, hiding from reality is the problem. Watching a movie isn't automatically, I've got to take a break from my paper now, I want to step out of reality. It could be, I need a break because my brain needs to do something different for a while.
But you stipulated that you're not taking a break from reality, and I can grant that. I mean, I think there are sometimes things that we do are for refreshment, for relaxation, or another kind of escape, other than escape from reality. But it seems to me there's another virtue that you touched on, and that is the sobriety, the awakeness, the being alert that the Bible talks about, redeeming the time that Paul talks about. The drinking of wine is dissipation. And I think the idea is we only really have a few precious minutes in this lifetime, and our purpose is to get in touch with God's purposes and have our lives invested in what his purposes are, which doesn't rule out sleep, refreshment, getting you know, restoration of energy, things that we need to learn to do. We can only concentrate so long, and then we need to rest and get our energy back. So entertainment is okay when it's a part of that restoration. But I know people who make entertainment their life, and they're frittering their life away. They don't serve people. They don't love people. They don't try to develop who God has created them to be in order that they might be useful to God. They're just frittering their life away. And it's kind of like there's a proverb, I don't remember where it is, about dissipation is like water in a desert where you spill it on the sand and it just disappears into the sand. It's no longer useful. It used to be useful. It was intended to be useful to you. And once you spill it on the sand, it ain't no use to nobody. And our lives should not be just spilled on the sand, and so they're not of any use to God. Even if I could argue, and we could talk about self-deception, how easy it is to tell us I'm not escaping from reality when I really am, but even if we stipulate, no, there's no self-deception, I'm really not escaping from any reality, I'm willing to face reality, I still have the issue of, is this the best use of my time? Am I redeeming the time? Am I dissipating? Am I engaged in dissipation? Or is this just creative entertainment that I'm using to refresh myself so that I can get on with what I really purpose my life to be about?
Any other questions?
So how would I find an equal balance between X, which is like all the good stuff, and Splinter Cell, which is an Xbox game?
The what?
An Xbox video game.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, so how do I find an equal balance between like Splinter Cell and the other stuff? I mean, like, do I just feel it? I mean...
Use the force.
Game. Do I just what would be a good... Because, like, I often have a conversation with Jessica, because Jessica's not a big fan of video games. That's why I love video games. And so, I mean, like, is it just a good opportunity to use other people to hold me accountable? Like, do you think I'm playing too much? I mean...
Mm-hmm. And I think other people can often see it before I would be able to see it. Because they'll recognize that you're so much of your life has given over to this thing. This doesn't look like, this is not what human existence is for.
Yeah, more than 2 hours a day, it's a problem.
Isn't there a sense, too, though, that, like, I mean, drugs sometimes, and they're just irresponsible. Like, it seems like there's a difference sometimes between going out and getting drunk and watching a movie that's just a complete waste of my time. That, like, I may not be using my time well in either situation, but at least if I'm just watching a movie that's a waste of time, I'm not going to... Yeah, put myself in danger or say things that I wouldn't say or do things that I wouldn't do. And it seems like the same thing with escaping, too, that there's lots of different ways that we can try and escape, but some of them are just irresponsible as well.
Some are more dangerous than others as well, yeah. Oh, Deanna?
Is it just from a historical view, is it kind of amazing that we live in a time that we have so much choice of like entertainment or escaping from reality? I mean, we don't have to scrabble for a living like people have done for so long. So it's almost like we have to... No, we can't play Scrabble for a living. Anyway, but we have to think about this. Maybe it's just something we've really been given that we have to deal with and mm-hmm. see in ourselves. And even seeing, I think about how there are people in my life who want to do things, and if I want to be with that person, sometimes when I know this is a waste of time for me, going to see this movie or whatever, there are all these different situations mm-hmm. that we
yeah.
have to deal with.
Yeah, it's. I think it's very difficult to make firm lines because so much of it's going to depend on what's motivating it, and that's something that we each have to be responsible with: is what are we responding to, what's motivating us, and how are we loving those around us,
and listening to their input and all those kinds of things. Yeah. Good. Okay. I think we're done.